Hey, can I talk to you? Over 25 years ago, on September 29th, 1998, we watched a brainy girl with curly hair drop everything to follow a guy she only kind of knew all the way to college. And so began Felicity. My name is Juliette Littman, and I'm a Felicity superfan. Join me, Amanda Foreman, who you may know better as Megan, the roommate, and Greg Grunberg, who you may also know as Sean Blunberg, as the three of us revisit our favorite moments from the show and talk to the people who helped shape it. Listen now to Dear Felicity on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is presented by Walmart Plus. Walmart Plus is the membership that helps you save on things you expect, plus the things you don't, like free delivery from your store with no markups, gas savings, and even a free Paramount Plus subscription. Start your free 30-day trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus Essential Plan only. Separate registration required. $35 order minimum. See walmart.com/plus for details. Nathan, we've got to start using Apple Cash.
Okay. Why?
It's so easy and convenient. Apple Cash lives in Messages, where you and I text all the time.
We do. All right.
So I can pay you in the convos we're already having, like I do when I bribe you to say nice things about my favorite Taylor Swift songs. You'll never forget a payment or have the money just sitting somewhere collecting dust.
You do owe me money from the last time we saw those Taylor and Travis pics, so that is nice.
And once I've done that, you can use that cash right away. You can buy stuff at a store with Apple Pay.
So I don't have to do all the bank transfer stuff then?
Nope. It's just right there. It's easy, convenient, and secure.
Wait, did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
See how easy that was? Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply. Welcome to Every Single Album. I'm Nora Brinciotti, and I am joined, as always, by Nathan Hubbard. Nathan, happy Maggie Rogers Day.
Happy Maggie Rogers Day. I mean, Sabrina Carpenter's putting out a single. Billy just announced her album. They're all trying to step on each other, but I am fired up to talk about Maggie Rogers. I have been excited about this album because you and I have been listening to it for a long time right now.
Yes. So happy Maggie Rogers Day. Happy Maggie Rogers Night. I think that we should start, as we often do, with a little bit of context, which is that you and I have been listening to this album for a little bit at this point, and we are lucky to be able to put this album out right as Don't Forget Me gets dropped and released, and everybody gets a chance to go enjoy it. Because, Nathan, I know you have some background with this. You have some context. You are both a Maggie fan, and also you've crossed paths with her, I believe. Tell us about your Maggie Rogers journey.
Yeah, well, my Maggie Rogers journey started long before I got to know her a little bit, but it started, I think, with a lot of people's, which was with the Pharrell video.
Wow. Wow. I have zero notes for that.
From when she was at the Clive Davis School at NYU Tisch and presented her song to Pharrell, and just you, if you have not watched that video, you are missing out, because it is the everything that's beautiful about music and the discovery of something, and just watching someone who has been in the studio with so many different artists and heard so much music over the course of his life fall in love instantaneously, and watching her authentically sheepish and unsure where to even place her gaze because she's introducing art to somebody who she respects. That was my initial initiation into the world of Maggie. And then fast forward
to
now.
Can I stop you for 1 second? Yes, just to share that I rewatched that video the other day in preparation for this. And one thing that I had forgotten about or just didn't initially appreciate was that no one knew Pharrell was coming to class.
It's wild.
They had no warning. That is the most NYU bullshit I've ever heard, of just like showing up on your final presentation day, and all of a sudden, not only are you presenting like this product of your own emotion and feeling, and I have a feeling the Venn diagram of people who have seen this video and know the story and who are listening to this podcast is a circle. But just in case Maggie Rogers presents her song Alaska, the idea of just whoever her professor was bombarding this poor class with having to share this with Pharrell Williams. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And I had not appreciated that initially when I'd seen that video, as I think so many of us did, as an initial introduction to her. Well, and
she's gotten to know him now, but for a long time, as that video sort of created her fame and ultimately propelled Heard It in a Past Life to debut at number two, everybody said, well, are you friends with him? And she's like, no, I'm not friends with him. That was just like a one-off. What you saw was what we, you know, what we got. There was no follow-up, or it's not like he kept texting her. Anyway, she obviously has spent a little more time with him at this point. So all's well that ends well.
Well, so keep going. Keep letting us know sort of how you've been a fan and have worked in conjunction with this person and since seeing that Pharrell video, where that took you.
Yeah, I mean, it took me just, again, as a fan to Heard It in a Past Life, and she had nomination for Best New Artist at the Grammys, and I think that that album is magic in a bottle, and we can talk more about it. Interestingly, produced by our friend Greg Kirsten, who did a lot of the Adele stuff, Nora. There's some total overlap between a bunch of the artists that we talk about and the producers who they work with. And I'm sure that that's not a complete surprise. But one thing led to another. And my company, Firebird, is partners with her manager. And so she's part of our ecosystem and part of our family. And we get to work every day helping to support her. So probably good context to have, because I'm definitely biased as I come in to this album. But I will say that, you know, when we first started working with her, it was shortly after Surrender came out. And I think in 2022, when that album dropped, there was a lot of anticipation. Obviously, it had been like 3 years since Heard It in a Past Life. And man, I have to say that out of the gates, that album did not land with a lot of people. And there was probably a moment, and I don't speak for Maggie, but I would imagine there was a moment where there was, whoa, now what happens? And what's fascinating about the journey from then to now, and you'll pardon the pun as we start to talk about one of the songs on this album, on this new album in a minute, called If Now Was Then. But from then to now, Maggie went out on the road and she just started playing. And the songs from Surrender are badass live. A song like Want Want. Yeah. And her fan base is passionate enough that they're going to come out and support her no matter what she does. You know, she went and she was frustrated with the ticketing fees. As a former CEO of Ticketmaster, I can certainly, that's not the first time that I've heard that. But, you know, Maggie went out and literally in person was standing in line with fans who were buying tickets from the box office without fees. Like, she always goes out into it and does the work. And it created a buzz about the tour where it just felt like her community of fans, and she has a community that is all about her, came together. And they discovered that album through the course of that tour. And I think the songs took on a new life. And I don't think it's then a surprise that this album, and really the intent of this album, as she sat down with Ian Fitchuk, who, as we talked about last week on Casey Musgraves, he recorded all of that record with Casey and also did Golden Hour, did Deeper Well.
He's becoming the Jack Antonoff of the like slightly more folk country girlies.
He is. And I don't mind it, because I think, yeah, this was a flash session where she reached out to him, DM'd him, and they did this entire record in 5 days. And the point of it for him anyway was to try to capture, there was a gap between Heard It in a Past Life, which has a lot of electronic, sort of very influenced by her time in clubs in Berlin, coupled with her love of folk and being a banjo player. It's sort of this wonderful mashup. Surrender was more of a sort of driving rock record a little bit.
Right. But you lose Ian, the sort of synth pop bleep bloop.
Yeah. And Ian really wanted to see if he could unify these two things, which was her recorded music and her live show, which I have to be honest, it took me a long time before I saw Maggie. And when I first went to see Maggie, it was totally different than I thought. I mean, the last show was more of a Pink pop show, meaning like Pink the artist, not because she's flying around on, you know, doing acrobat stunts and stuff. That's not what she was doing.
Although she does kind of, and I mean this in such a positive way, she kind of flails.
Absolutely, she flails. But she's like, there's this like big persona and
yeah.
And part of confidence to her that live, I just didn't expect to see how big she is as a personality on the stage, because behind the scenes, she's much more reserved and her voice can at times feel delicate and some of her songwriting is very intimate. And so that was something that was really special that I think Ian noticed himself and they tried to capture on this record. I mean, there's a lot of this stuff. You cannot make a record like this in 5 days unless you're doing a lot of first take, keep the energy, let's get it right. You know, a writing session that I think in a lot of ways reinvigorated Maggie. As we'll talk about, she's still writing. They're still working, even though this album is done. And I think it inspired her to come back to a place of creativity. And we should also say, Nora, that between Past Life and this album, Don't Forget Me, was Surrender for sure. But she went to Divinity School at Harvard.
Yeah. And
she did that really specifically, I think, because she was trying to figure out how to balance being like a normal human being who is famous and creating this sort of creative space for herself in a world in which, you know, she's talked about by some of her fan base, she's treated, if not as a deity, pretty close, right? The sort of hero idol worship that we all have of the musical stars who create the soundtracks of our life, I think was hard for Maggie. Took a lot for a kid who grew up in rural Maryland and spends a lot of time in rural Maine to absorb that. And so she turned to schooling to try to help create that creative space. And it feels like with this record and on a go-forward basis, she's been reinvigorated.
The NYU alum turned artist whose thesis I would most like to get a hold of is Lady Gaga's NYU thesis on Damien Hirst. But Maggie's grad thesis on, it was like the nature of pop stardom and its relationship yeah. with religiosity and the spirituality of group gatherings. I've read the title of it somewhere, so I'm paraphrasing, but I don't have it in front of me right now. That's a close second. I would be interested.
Yeah. Well, it was Surrender, and her performance at Coachella last year was part of the presentation of her thesis. So she's
so
literally
badass.
Sort of taken this academia and turned it into performance art.
It's very cool. So if I can give you my own sort of background.
Yeah,
here,
I want to know how you discovered Maggie, because you were excited when I suggested that we do the Maggie record and we have not compared notes on why this was exciting for you.
Well, so it's funny. It's funny that you thought that it was that I seemed excited, and I'm glad it came across that way. And I was excited because I'm excited when we do anything and I'm really interested in Maggie Rogers and I love a lot of her work. But I do wonder if you sensed that, because I was maybe overcompensating a little bit.
Okay.
Because here's the deal.
It's new. And
you know, we're always very honest with each other. There was 10% of me that was a little nervous about doing this.
Okay.
Because I know that you have a working relationship with her. I know that you are also a huge and passionate fan of this woman. I have considered myself, I've followed Maggie Rogers since, you know, I too saw the Pharrell Alaska video sort of before I knew her as an artist, but have paid attention since the first album. And I have always been a huge admirer of her. But it's been a little bit more, like, academic is maybe not the right word. It's always been something where I was admiring more than I was truly, like, loving or moved.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I connected in a way that was sort of aesthetic. And I thought, oh, these songs, they sound cool. I hear the connection between, you know, the dance clubs of Berlin and natural samples coming from the woods. Like, I get the point of the project and I get it. And I'm interested in it. And it's certainly in my wheelhouse. And the live show portion of that, I've seen her. And I can also tell you that I think 90% of my friends have seen Maggie Rogers on tour at some point, have seen a Maggie Rogers live show, which is just a byproduct of the fact that, to your point, she really went out and did it for a long time. So she's really felt like in a lot of sandboxes that I'm interested in. And I've really appreciated her work. But there's been something a little bit like, I'm just not totally clicking with this.
A degree removed. Yeah.
And I wondered how that would come across if it was something that you cared about. And I was a little bit like, I want to get it, but I don't. It's just like maybe a little too new agey for me or something.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I clicked almost instantly with this album. And I have such a clearer sense of who she is as a person. Maybe. I mean, I don't know, you know, but like I have an idea of who I think that is.
Yeah.
In a way that's compelling to me after hearing this collection of songs. And it really moved me. And I really was like fist bumping. Not that we couldn't have navigated it if I didn't like it or if it didn't quite work for me. And I would have told you the truth.
We've done this
before. But I was
just
like, I was like, what am I going to do if I don't like this album? And I really like this album, Nathan.
Okay. Well, that makes me super excited. I'm even happier that that's the story that you come to this from. I mean, Maggie is in a tough spot as an artist because she was thrust unknowingly into people's faces as an artist as she was, right? This moment of unbelievable shyness and vulnerability. And as so many people fell in love with her, authenticity. But in some ways, I think that can be a constraint for Maggie because people just want her. Right. And it makes it hard for her to put on a mask, right? In the way that so many of these other pop girls can go through eras. Taylor Swift, yes, there's an authenticity to Taylor, but I mean, you know, this past week, she just reframed her entire catalog along the five stages of grief. I mean, come on. She can do whatever she wants, but she gets to wear a lot of masks, right? Maggie started being this person that people connected with foundationally, and it makes it harder for her to stray from that, I suspect. And I think that's what a lot of the Divinity School work was about, just trying to create enough space for her to maintain that authenticity, but also be an artist that wears different shades, right? Her synesthesia probably would see a color in the way that we're talking about this. But I think that's actually a really interesting challenge. And what I think is lovely about this record is what you just said. It's just her.
Yeah. No, it struck me to hear that in the record, but it also struck me that, you know, there's a New Yorker profile of her talking about the making of this record out that by the time this comes out, it'll be a few days old. And it's really, she's great in it and it's interesting and you learn a lot. And I would encourage anybody to go read it. And I'm not saying that this is bad by the author or anything. It just, the Pharrell thing is the second paragraph.
Yeah.
Like, it's just crazy how long of a tail that video has had. And I think
it's the story of her stardom and it's hard to shake, isn't
it? And she didn't choose that, right? Like, she did not choose that was to be the story of her stardom and the sort of origin story of her career. And it also, I mean, heard in a past life of the two prior albums, I'm partial to Heard It in a Past Life over
Me
Surrender.
Too.
That album, when I say that there was like just a little bit of remove for me, I do really like it. But I think that it became weirdly controversial for people. And when I say controversial, I mean for people who obsess about like indie pop folk artists, which is a subset of people. But for those people, it became weirdly controversial because it was like she was bridging these identities of this woman who loves to be in the woods and who loves to be connected with the natural world and also cares deeply and authentically about her art and who had this origin story where it seemed like it just came out of nowhere, like it was magic or something. And then people start to recontextualize it as, okay, well, she's at the Clive Davis program at NYU Tisch, blah, 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 blah. And it's Pharrell Williams and she's in like, and I think that's sort of odd and unfair. And like, why can't she want to go on a hike and also understand that her art is also a career and that those are two things that have to be sort of connected in some way, shape or form, or are perfectly fine to be connected. And so I just, it, I think I knew how long of a tail that experience had had, but it maybe hadn't fully like clicked for me.
Right.
Just how big of a thing hanging over her that had been. And maybe I hear, maybe part of what I like so much in this album is a little bit of getting past that and just being like, oh, I'm going to do this on my own terms and show you a bit of myself. Even though not all of these stories are about her. So I had a really good time with it. Do you want to kick things off? This is going to be another example of we're talking about an album so fresh that biggest hit is a little bit challenging.
Yeah.
Don't forget me. The title track is going to be the one with the big head start.
So close the door, change the channel. Give me something I can handle.
I'll ask you sort of to fill out this category. Is there anything else that you feel like is relevant or you want to say about sort of the aims of the album, the stakes and the goals and who she's trying to reach with it?
No, I don't know that she's got a vision for that. I think she just wanted to make a great record. In terms of biggest hit, I think, Don't Forget Me, I wanted it to be Don't Forget Me. But I think when this record comes out, there's going to be a focus on the song The Kill.
So difficult, so invincible, irresistible, but I loved you still.
And I think it's going to be The Kill.
Wow.
I really do. I think...
Okay, talk to me.
Yeah, I just... That song is going to translate live in ways that... I mean, it's just... It's badass. Everything from the sort of tension in a relationship with somebody when the other person isn't all the way in, and the imagery of the shoes you laid out for me from the ones who came before.
The shoes you laid out for me from the girls that came before.
Yeah, it's a good line.
And just sort of the ongoing groove of that song is, I think it's going to set, and we'll see. But, they started with Don't Forget Me. I think it's a really big song, and she put it out on Instagram with her just playing piano. I guess it was late last year.
Oh, but promise me that when it's time to leave.
And man, I was so excited for it. I love this song on the record. I really do. I would say two things. One is I wanted her to have a huge vocal moment at the end of Don't Forget Me. And instead, for whatever reason, the choice that they made was to sort of retreat with a soft end.
Don't forget me.
I felt like she could have had a big, like, high, booming, don't forget me, and just, like, nail it, because she's capable of doing that. And I just came away feeling like I love the song. I didn't think the arrangement of the song totally did justice to it. It's still great and it sits with me, and the people in my house sing it all the time, and I have the melodies. Like, it's a beautiful song. But the solo piano version of Don't Forget Me was absolutely stunning. And I think there's a ton of great lines. Wreck My Sundays, I loved. I don't know. How did you feel about Don't Forget Me?
Yeah, no, this is one of a couple songs that really, really moves me.
Yeah.
And I just, look, one of the
things that
I love
that it's last.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that I could handle a big vocal moment at the end. I mean, there are I think three songs in the album that the first time through just had me in tears. And what I found really moving about this album was just hearing it as a collection of songs about growing up and kind of recognizing as you get a little bit older the simultaneous like joy and pain of only getting to live one life and just having to live your choices and have your regrets and also have the things that you're proud of and your friendships and love and hoping. And it really was an emotional song for me.
Yeah.
So I think that it really, like, as we talk about all of these artists who are having their Saturn return moments, this was a very effective version of that. And I have a feeling it'll resonate with a lot of people. I'm really interested in you going for The Kill. I'm now trying to put myself in a place to kind of hear it in my head live, because I think that would be really interesting. I really like that song. I really enjoy it. I would not have pulled it for this category.
Huh.
Kind of at all, even though I do really like it. I think, what do you hear In for the Kill meaning in that song? And
you
were going
in for the kill. You were going in for the kill. I mean, I think it's getting your own needs met without necessarily being all the way in to meet somebody else's.
Okay. All right.
And I love the line that's in there. It's just this sort of, you know, she plays both sides of it. In one case, she's the killer. In the other case, he's the killer. But in both cases, it's sort of this tension of we're in it, we're doing the things, you know, we're wearing each other's clothes, but one of us is not all the way there. But we're getting our needs met, and that's the sort of sinister nature to it. And that's how the shuffle of the groove feels to me. It's how the chord progression feels to me. I don't know. I think even she's gonna crush this live.
Even lyrically, outside of that, like, I love all of the different moments on that song where it's like, you know that I know that, and it has that back and forth and the duality of dynamics where either it's no one's fault or both people are a little at fault, which I think I give her a lot of credit for trying to do that. Because in some ways, you know, she's talked about this album not as a breakup album quite so simply as that, but it has a lot of those themes and it has a lot of like looking back on a past relationship. And she's very willing to live in the messiness of that and also be a little bit guilty herself. And it's easier to do it the other way. So I give her a lot of credit for it. I'm now very excited to hear this song live. May I ask you, because the other song that they put out earlier, which would have been the other thing that I would have brought up, is
So Sick of Dreaming.
You think you're so cool. Everybody knows you, but what's so good about that? Which is kind of her that don't impress me much. Now you think you're cool, but have you got the touch?
Don't get me wrong. Yeah, I think you're all right. It is. Or maybe, as we'll talk about, her We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together.
Yes.
Look, it was an interesting choice to put that one out. I think, look, if you think about her in a past life.
Wasn't that interesting, Nathan? This song sounds like it belongs on the soundtrack to like a 2004 rom-com. It's like I don't know that it was that interesting of a choice. I think it's a great song that everyone is going to love.
Yeah. Look, it could easily be like a Sheryl Crow song from Tuesday Night Music Club, right?
Right.
And it is a great song. And that interlude, I think there was some consternation about whether she should be making fun of the Knicks and would that turn people off.
I always make fun of the Knicks.
Dreaming. And by the way, the Knicks lost.
But to put it in, you know, the first record, Heard It in a Past Life, had some bops, right? And it had some stuff that was a little bit more upbeat. And I think Don't Forget Me, which may be the best written song on the record, maybe with the one exception that we'll talk about in my view, but Don't Forget Me, it's not a banger. It's not a total bop. The way that they ended up producing the song, right? And so I think the reason that The Kill is probably a focus from here is because that's a song that you could see across multiple formats of radio.
Right.
And it could be that So Sick of Dreaming could get there, but I think it's just such a fun, like it is so classic Maggie that they went with it. I still think, in my view, they have two quote unquote hits that are still in the bag. And that's The Kill. And as we'll talk about, it's If Now Was Then. But So Sick of Dreaming, tell me like when she goes into the interlude and it starts, So He Calls Me Up, which is
I did have a flashback.
Did you have a complete, wait a minute.
So he calls me up 15 minutes before the reservation and says he's got Knicks tickets instead.
So he calls me up and he's like, I still love you. And I'm like, exhausting.
I was like, hold on, where did this come from? No, it's like it's when you get to the end of 1989 Taylor's version, and your brain is so trained to think that it's going to be the deluxe edition, and you're just waiting for the voice memo to start. Yeah, no, I had like a Pavlovian response to think she was about to be like, so he calls me up and he's like, I still love you. And I'm like, this is exhausting. But
there
course,
is a parallel, Nora. There's no way that this isn't either consciously or subconsciously tied in. I mean, I called her manager and I said, did she mean to do this or not? And he didn't. I don't know that he'd even made the connection in that moment because he's not as much of a Taylor Swift freak as you and I are. But I mean, okay, Maggie
Rogers, Tim McGraw cover. Maggie Tim McGraw cover Rogers knows what she's doing.
The best cover of a Taylor Swift song that exists.
You think Tim McGraw, hope you think of me.
She knows what she's doing here, right?
Yes. I'm spoiling some future categories. I think there are like 19 Easter eggs in here. I think the Knicks tickets thing, I'm pretty sure that's a Sex and the City plot line.
I'm sorry.
You should be. I'd box seats to a Yankee doubleheader.
Oh, damn. Who'd you take? Someone
who returned. But I think there are just like 19 layers of doing bits and making references that all the girls are going to get. Yes. And it's really fun.
Yeah.
And you get definitely a little bit of Shania here too. Like I'm waiting for her to say, girls. So you're Brad Pitt.
So you're Brad Pitt. That don't impress me much.
It's right. Just so good.
Yeah. It's a really, really fun song.
This was the type of thing that made me like, it's a silly thing. It's a bit, it's a joke. She's like riffing. It felt lived in a way, and like sort of like visceral and funny. And she felt like a person singing this song in a way that I was like, oh, this is the piece that I have missed from Maggie Rogers. And I just was like, oh fuck. Very cool.
She's easy to fall in love with. Yeah. It's what she's good at, I think. And to your point, like, it sounds like there's a bunch of like girl bat signals coming out of this song that I don't even get.
And by the way, the Knicks lost.
Right.
It's so funny. It's really good. Also, like,
I think there was a conversation, you know, maybe from the label side. I think there was conversation about, should we do a version without this? And I think it totally makes the song. And I think people are going to understand, like, she knows what she's doing with that.
Also, like, the Knicks lose plenty. Like, it's fine. It's just the Knicks.
They're having a good season. People are happy.
I mean, in the arc of history, but yes, we don't know when this story took place.
But there are those undertones, aren't there, here? Like if Heard It in a Past Life made you go, wow, there's some electronic and some folk together. That's not this record. This record could be a Linda Ronstadt record. Or a Pat Benatar record. Or a Stevie Nicks solo album. Just like the White Wing does, sing the song, says I should sing it. That's the vibe that you get out of this.
Yeah, or like I get a lot of Shania. I get a lot
Cheryl.
Maybe. I get plenty of Sheryl Crow. All I wanna do is have some fun. Yeah, a little bit of like Michelle Branch. There's a lot of like, we have really left most of our synth pop bleep bloops behind. And I have to imagine that was in some ways the intent, although I do know the story of, which I think you referenced, that these were mostly first takes and were not necessarily all intended to be the final cuts. But then anytime they tried to re-record, they felt like they lost something.
That's how it always
and
goes.
And so they ended up going with the originals. So there is something very, very raw and very off the cuff that I think sounds really good and comes through. And her voice is amazing and sounds so good. So it totally works. And so I don't know if that lends itself to this being a much more sort of not in the barn. Like it's not a country album, but there's something very just sort of live band to it.
Yep. For sure. If that was the intent, it is what they captured.
I mean, you think that I am interested, and obviously that's like a little bit of a continuation of some of the evolution that she had on Surrender, which was a little bit more rocky, and some of that comes through here too. But the original Maggie Rogers concept had so much to do with like the club in Berlin. The club in Berlin is not really present on this album.
No, it is not. And listen, it's been 5 years since she put that record out, and even longer since she was actually in the club in Berlin. So it does feel like growth of an artist, but also like you can hear the influences that she's had as an artist, right? And she's almost more of like Joan Baez, Joni Mitchell lineage than, I don't know, whatever your synth pop star might be, right? She has these roots in Carole King.
And it's too late, baby, now it's too late.
Yeah, that come out on this record in really interesting ways that I think, again, because of the kind of artist that she is, it feels authentic and evolutionary, not like it's being lifted.
So I think you hinted that there's another song in addition to The Kill that you're pretty sweet on. So let's move to best song. And I'm hoping that you'll share that in this category.
Yeah. To me, it's If Now Was Then.
But if now was then, I would get out of my head, I would touch your chest.
And I think it's the best song on the record. I love the regret and lament after a relationship is over, sort of during the demise. I think it's the best Maggie vocal performance on the album. I think the way her voice goes between thirds, it's the sort of classic Maggie trick. Here she's going from an A to a C sharp, and her voice sort of breaks just a little bit on the high note. The
like when she throws it up in the air, it sounds like.
Exactly. And it's a technique that she uses across other songs. But here, this song just builds. It starts and you think you're just kind of listening to just a kind of stripped down acoustic song.
Standing on the edge of our old corner on Broadway.
And by the end of the song, there's huge voices, there's huge synths. The I Take It Back But I Can't, I'm Sorry.
I Take It Back But I Can't, I'm Sorry.
It's got some of the synths from Streets of Philadelphia by Springsteen.
The Streets of Philadelphia.
Like right as he comes out of the Streets of Philadelphia in the chorus, there's some similar stuff that's happening, but this song doesn't feel at all like that song. It just builds and builds and builds. And I heard it and I stopped the first listen. I was driving down to San Diego in the morning early when I first got access to this and listened to it. And I stopped, and that's when I called and I was like, this song. And this is the song. It's the song that I know that when Zach Bryan heard it, Zach Bryan told Maggie, that's the one. So I don't know where it's going to make its appearance. They didn't obviously choose it as a single. It's a different direction, right? It's a different song than Don't Forget Me. It's a different song than So Sick of Dreaming. But man, this one is the one for me that I just cannot get enough of it.
You know what it reminded me was? I paused it in the middle and was like, what song am I thinking of right now? Like, what am I having this reaction to? Nobody's Home by Avril Lavigne.
But if
interesting.
Go back, like you go back and it's more, there's a little bit in the music of it, but it's more just sort of a vibe once it gets into the second half of the song and it picks up a little. I love this song. This is another one that in my notes, I wrote down so rom-com soundtrack vibes,
oh,
which 100%. To me is high compliment.
Yeah. 100%.
So yeah, I I'm fascinated, but not that surprised that we have reactions to slightly different songs. I really like If Now Is Then, and I really like The Kill. I don't know that I would have flagged them in quite the same way, but I do think as I was filling out my own categories, this wasn't an album, and it's not, you know, this is a curated, she did this in 5 days.
Right.
There was editing here, which we love. Yeah. So in some ways, I think this makes sense that there aren't huge, huge standouts and huge, huge like underperformers or whatever. There were a lot of songs that I considered for best song. To me, it ended up coming down to Don't Forget Me.
Yeah.
Never Going Home.
Wow.
Made me weep.
Wow.
Made me cry tears out of my eyeballs.
Tell me why.
Again, I love, and we'll get there, but the presence of her friends on the album and just the storytelling I felt was so perfectly evocative of, look, Maggie
Rogers. This is what happens with women and Maggie. Like, she is instantly their best friend. There's some like laser beam that connects and she is their best friend. That's the essence of the fan base around Maggie. It's why
she is 2 months older than me. So like, recognize that there is, and also like, we are, you know, I'm not going to compare myself to this woman and all of her accomplishments, but we were both like, grew up in relatively rural places, moved to cities, like went to prep school. Like her worldview works for me in a lot of ways. And this was a song where I really heard that. And I cried. Like the idea of mourning, but celebrating, like your path is your path.
Put on my red lipstick like a hero and swallow the fear down my throat.
And, right. You know, there's pain in that. And there's also a huge amount of joy in it. At the cusp of turning 30. I'm just telling you it works. Okay, Nathan, okay. It works.
No, I believe you. It's a fascinating perspective. I heard the I going into the chorus sounds a lot like the I going into the chorus of So Sick of Dreaming. Which felt like in the span of 5 days, there's going to be little ideas and musical stuff that get sprinkled across the record. And I like it for that reason. But that's interesting that you had that reaction. What else? I, by the way, I agree with you. I think in the aggregate, Don't Forget Me is the best written song on this record. It just is a beautiful, beautiful, wonderful song, period.
Yeah. Can I rant for a sec?
Yes, please, Nora. You know, I love when you do.
Pay apps are way too public.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Okay, so some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it is super weird. Well, how are you going to pay your friends then? I'm asking for a friend.
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC, terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by NetSuite by Oracle. The less your business spends, the more margin of money you have. I think that's pretty obvious for everyone, but actually doing it, that's easier said than done because the cost of everything is going up these days. So do the smart thing. Switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth so you can easily reduce costs and headaches. NetSuite specifically helps by reducing IT costs since it lives in the cloud with no hardware required and cutting the costs of maintaining multiple systems since everything you need is on OneSuite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See for yourself how effective NetSuite can be and try it out today. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/ringer. That is netsuite.com/ringer.
The third one for me was So Sick of Dreaming.
Okay.
And well, if now is then, definitely also, there was probably a version of that list where it was four songs and it also had If Now Is Then on it.
Yeah. Well,
but
I think
those three for me were particularly sticky.
Yeah, I think there's a reason Kill is four and If Now Is Then was five. I mean, those are ones that sort of are in that meat section of the track five-y part of the album, almost like a baseball team lineup. But you get thrown a little bit because Don't Forget Me's last. And so you think you're coming in for this soft landing. There's only 10 songs. It's pretty concise. But you think you're coming in for this soft landing. And like you said, I mean, the eighth song on the record is Never Going Home.
Yeah, it felt like a little moment of, in some ways, lightness, although it's not there is sort of so much bittersweet in that. But the thing about I can hear my friends saying there's 10 seconds until it's time to go, like that's a really,
yeah,
that is a very visceral vignette.
There's all music playing, I can hear my friends saying there's 10 seconds till it's time to go.
And it's also kind of a bop.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's a chill bop. It's
yeah.
Like a sweet bop.
Yeah.
It's like a bop that's going to give you a little hug. It's nice.
It's a huggy bop. I'm struck by the fact that the album we talked about last week was recorded in the same place as this album by the same guy and produced by the same guy.
Electric Lady Studios.
Yeah. There's an interesting, I mean, that place obviously is a magnet at this point. But I mean, this guy, Ian did the Casey record. He co-produced and co-wrote Amen by Beyonce on Cowboy Carter.
The statues they made were beautiful, but they were lies of stone.
Yeah.
So we've had a lot of overlap with him. And you know, in hindsight, he's clearly got range. And it is interesting just the ways in which he, in all three of these cases, seems to have been able to connect with the artist and get the best out of her, whatever it was that she was trying to create in that moment. But I will say, like, the melodies that come off of this record to me feel more interesting and developed, and lyrically the songs feel richer to me than, you know, than some of the things that Ian's worked on before. So I'm speaking largely of the Casey record, I guess. But I just found the sort of juxtaposition of these two couldn't have been recorded that too far apart, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, and it's hard to tell where did the melodies come from Maggie, where did they come from Ian? This is obviously, like, this is a person who has a huge songwriting background and is intimately involved. And I do think, I mean, you were talking about that vocal trick. It's not really a trick, but just when she throws a melody up and her voice reaches that sort of ethereal plane, to me that's very signature Maggie Rogers. I mean, that's it's all over Alaska, and I think it's something that to me sonically is a through line in all of her work that, you know, that's one of those things that I can hear and I could call out, oh, that's a Maggie Rogers song.
So it sings. And now breathe deep, I'm in
it. And whoever, and I shouldn't say whoever was responsible as though there's a right answer. They did this together very clearly. When an album has so few people involved in it, like, it's a collaboration.
Yeah.
They managed to get a lot of that all over this thing without it seeming overly intentional or overly bogged down. So there's clearly an understanding of how to work with her voice and the melodies too. I found them interesting. I found them sticky, but especially it stood out to me that it seems like there was a real understanding of how to play to the strengths. Do you bring up our friend Ian? I also should say that, I mean, Maggie seems to be a pretty good talent scout in some ways, because I was revisiting some of the earliest coverage because I went down this rabbit hole of like, geez, like this Pharrell thing was really like, that was intense. That was all anybody talked about with this woman for so long. Like, what was the deal? And so I was revisiting some early coverage and she's worked with Kid Harpoon. On her past two records. And there was a fair bit of like, some guy named Kid Harpoon, like, who's this guy? Don't know who this guy is.
Right. Who goes so on she's been, to do Harry's record that wins Album of the Year.
Yeah. So she's been early on some people before. So, you know, shout out to Ian.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, she's got a great connection with him and they're going to continue to make more music, it appears. So that's really cool. But look,
do you bring this up because he's as most important collaborator?
Yeah, I do.
So I think in a sort of straight down the middle sense, that is objectively correct. But can I offer you another one here?
Please do.
Her friends. I mean, her friends are all over this record.
Okay.
And it was coming all along. She talks about talking to her friend Nora on the phone.
And I'm trying to be brave these days, but oh, I've still got Nora.
Oh, there you go. That's how
love a fellow Nora.
Yeah. Sally and Molly.
My friend Sally's getting married. To me, that sounds so scary. My friend Molly's got a guy she says to God could be a family.
Sally and Molly getting married.
And don't forget me.
Mentioned the never going home. Scene that she writes where, you know, everybody's getting ready to go do something and you're having a glass of wine while everyone's doing their hair and picking out clothes and someone's not moving fast enough and there's an Uber downstairs and it's going to pull away in 30 seconds and everybody has to get in the elevator and go like that. That was just really palpable. The interlude in So Sick of Dreaming is both, you know, it's as told to friends, but it also mentions going down the street to meet her friends.
I took the steak to go. I had two martinis at the bar. Went to meet my friends down the street.
And again, there's just a, she's, there was a world building to this that I thought gave it personality and like a sense of place and a sense of, it just made it so much more tangible to me. And I think her, you know, you're saying there's this thing where people want to be her friend. Well, it seems like she cares a lot about her friends. Like you know, writing friendship into song is really lovely because first of all, sometimes I think it's shortchanged. Like it's so, there are 800 zillion love songs, right? Or breakup songs. There's so much about romantic relationships. Friendships sometimes get the short shrift in artistic treatments. And I like that she is spending time doing that. It feels real. I just loved hearing Maggie write about her friends. So they in spirit seemed to be collaborators to me.
And yet a lot of this album is about the demise of a relationship that I think, as she refers to in that New Yorker piece, it was sort of like a premonition or something.
Well, because, she says it wasn't.
Yeah.
I think she said it wasn't. And I mean, you know.
Right. Right.
Who knows? Was Midnight's a threat?
Yeah, it was. that's why I thought, listen, I thought the sort of notable Easter egg for me on this record was Del Water Gap, Holden Jaffe, who's she dated, and it feels like many of these songs are about him. I think they were in school together. I think the song that they do together called New Song is absolutely incredible. And they toured together last year and she brought him out. He opened for her and she brought him out and they sang that sort of, it was very much like a Silver Springs, like Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham staring at each other singing. Like there was major intensity. It was a high point of the show. But yeah, he's a producer on a few of the songs. So he sort of is in and out of this record. And I wonder, as you say, I wonder how much was actually going on inside her emotionally about that relationship as she was writing this.
And maybe some of the friendship stuff is a way to channel that almost without being so on the nose about it, right? Because your anxiety is about all your friends getting married and are people, you know, again, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make this about me. It's not all about me.
but is what she does.
Well, and when you're 30, when you're right on the cusp of 30, it's very true that like some of your friends are about to have their second kids and some of your friends are going on 6 Hinge dates a week. Like it's a time when people feel in some ways like you're just past that school time where your friendships are sort of built in, right? Like you're with so many of your peers and then all of a sudden you're out in the world and people, you know, they take different paths. And when you get to be around that age, everybody's sort of figuring out like, oh, what does it mean that I'm doing this and they're doing that? And sometimes seeing yourself through your friends, they're doing this and I'm doing that. What does that mean about them? What does that mean about me? Is sort of a way of channeling, what do I think about this relationship? What do I think about my relationship? What do I think about the fact that my relationship ended? And so I wonder if that was a tool to not be quite so on the nose about it. But I also just think that it's very true to life. And as I think there are a lot of roughly 30-year-old women in her fan base, again, I just imagine that it's going to work for people.
Yeah. Well, they subscribe. She's got a newsletter that she puts. I mean, she's kind of... I mean, I think she can sort of be a...
How do we get the Maggie Rogers newsletter Dua Lipa book club crossover event of the century?
Yeah, I think she can be like a more grounded goop, honestly, because I think for all the reasons that you're laying out here, like she got you in the same way that she's gotten so much of her fan base. I think she's just, you know, she's easy to love in that way for a lot of, in particular, for a lot of women who just feel connected to her because there's just an authenticity to her and perspective that feels familiar.
That's all 100% right. I just want to go on the record. I don't need a more grounded goop. If anything, I need a less grounded goop.
You need unhinged?
Gwyneth? Yeah. Well, I mean,
unhinged.
We're not
goop?
Fully hinged as is, but like the more off the rails we want to go, I'm not buying, but I'm observing and I'm observing willingly. Okay. I don't go to goop for my grounding. I go to goop for like insane.
Well, I know
travel guides to Bratislava and absolutely absurd facial products.
Yeah. Weird jade crystals that and scented candles of like female body parts and things. Yes.
Not crystals. Crystals would be a bad idea.
Yeah.
Spiky.
Well, what would you cut if you had to?
Okay. So what a transition. This is like the most Nora answer of all time. And I do think I want to give a lot of credit for the fact that this is a concise collection of songs.
Yes.
That
it struggles architecturally if you cut one, I feel like. But yeah.
Yeah. Ahead. And I don't feel the need to be cutting here. And I really do. All of our content is too long. Movies are too long. Albums are too long. So I really want to be like, good on you guys for doing some editing with the length here. I will say that I didn't quite know what to do with either of the ballads.
Okay. I still do.
Yeah. All the same. And I still do.
Until one day you wake up and you realize that what you see is what you know. Bend, how far can you bend before you break it all?
part of that was like, even some of the most up-tempo songs on this album were sort of emotionally resonant to me. So the moments mm-hmm. when she's sort of asking you to sit down and just listen, I just kept, you know, I was like, I don't know what to do with my hands. so yeah. I ended up saying that I would actually cut all the same.
I understand it. I mean, this song feels very old soul, feels like an outtake of Blue. The sure. vibrato in her voice is very Joni. The guitar feels like Nick Drake, Pink Moon to me almost.
I saw it written and I saw it say.
I get it. Isn't it strange that for someone who communicate so effectively in such a feeling like such an intimate way that it's the two most stripped down songs that maybe don't land as much? I mean, I still do. That sounds like a Carole King song to me. It's got shades of Songbird. It's got the piano at the end feels like that song Lullaby by Billy Joel to me.
Well, and I still do.
Good night, my angel. Time to close your eyes.
And I think she's communicating something that is real for her, but I guess I'm with you that those two I'd put them in the category.
There's something in both of them for me in the sense that I think the story in All the Same, I actually found a little bit more compelling of the two. I still do. I thought her voice sounded particularly lovely.
Yeah.
So it's not there's something in both of them. I just didn't quite sink my teeth into either. And ultimately, I put All the Same in the category because I felt like she just sounds really great on I Still Do. And that seemed worth sticking it out on. Like you're in the same place.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same place. No, I didn't. I mean, no, I think I wouldn't put anything else into that category. It just leaves a tier of songs like On and On and On.
And it goes on and on and on when you hear this song.
Which I really love, and the bass and guitar. I mean, it actually sort of sounds like a John Mayer song to me. I Don't Trust Myself with Loving You. But there's that cute little Maggie-ism at the end. You better run.
Yeah, you better run.
Yeah, you better run.
I also wrote, sometimes I go back to my notes and I'm like, what did I mean by this? Under this song, I wrote, "This is going on," and then in all caps, "Playlists." Like I'm Oprah. Like what?
Yeah.
Okay. I like that song.
You get a playlist, and you get a playlist. Yeah, I love that song too. And look, I like Drunk. Drunk to me, I mean, she references On and On and On. Lyrically in that song. That feels like Pat Benatar, Love is a Battlefield.
I'm drunk, not taken, lost in wishful thinking. You're breaking me cold and making me stay.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a little darker. Like there's, there's so much that has that great, like, 90s, early 2000s rom-com aesthetic where it's just like you're driving in a car and you want to listen to the songs and they're sort of bright, even if a lot of the storytelling she's engaging with is certainly not saccharine and is bittersweet most of the time. That Drunk is, I think, cool because it is a little darker sonically.
Yeah, there's more minor tension on this album from a chord perspective.
It really reminded me of the Chicks, Not Ready to Make Nice.
Interesting.
On the road, not in a
good. Like in a, I paused it and was like, what song am I singing in the back of my head? And it took me like 45 seconds to figure out what it was. And I was like Googling lyric fragments being like, what fucking song is this? But that's what it was.
Well, that's cool. I can live with that. I think it was Coming All Along as a great warm-up first pitch album intro. I think those are all songs that are worthy. They don't, because I do think there are a couple that are transcendent on this record. They don't go into that category, but they're it's a really good listen. And I don't think that the ballads, I Still Do and All the Same, I don't think they get in the way of the flow from start to finish.
But I mean, this is not a long album.
No, I'm with you that I won't go back to them individually in the way that, like, I am wearing the fuck out on If Now Was Then and The Kill. I am wearing those songs out.
One thing I love about, just because you mentioned it was Coming All Along as sort of the setup, and I really enjoyed that song too. I did really appreciate it, and it really kind of primed the pump for me to realize that this is going to be my favorite Maggie record and that I was going to connect with it in a way that I hadn't quite gotten there with the past two was the, I know it might sound existential if this is the first time that we meet.
No, it might sound existential if this is the first time that we meet.
Which I put down as peak Maggie, just because in some ways I think that has been, that's been my point of disconnect is like, I'm just this, like, it's like a little too new agey. It's a little too woo woo. Hmm. I'm not quite getting the, like, I'm hearing ideas about sort of the world and fame and being at peace and less so than I'm hearing like a person. So I think the fact that she just said that, I was like, oh, you understand how I feel. And you're I don't know. So it really worked for me. So I like that song.
Can we have a quick conversation about an area that always seems to get me in trouble, but I think it's important context to have. And that is her hair.
No.
Yes. Nathan. Yes, I know. But we're going to talk about it because it's a thing. It's a thing that her fans take notice of and talk about. And when she went to the pixie cut on Surrender, there was like online chatter about that. And that in some ways for some fans, I guess it felt harder to access her through that record because of the haircut. But I think it speaks.
Okay, can we just stop and recognize that that is an unhinged sentence?
Completely unhinged. Completely unhinged. And thank goodness that she is enough of an artist and not, you know, Googling Maggie Rogers or searching Maggie Rogers on Twitter all the time to be able to keep space from that. But imagine being in that position where, you know, how you wear and cut your hair like makes, I mean, listen, Taylor sort of lives with that in a certain way, right? But like there was like a bunch of fan feedback when she went to this pixie cut.
Yeah, but that's weird. Like if Taylor cut her hair, people would be weird about it, but in a different way. I don't think anyone would be like, I can't connect with the album because she got a bob. Like Taylor got a bob and it was fine.
But it speaks to the frontier edge of the fan base that, you know, maybe gets borderline obsessive of any artist fan base.
Also, I think
where they feel like she's their best friend.
Doesn't it speak to also kind of the, I'm going to be really dramatic, but like the prison of authenticity.
Exactly.
And like, if you are an artist where part of the, you know what? I will say sales pitch because that sort of proves my point.
Sure.
Is this like quasi spirituality and like connection to life and nature. And, you know, you're not trying to be Madonna. It's not eras. It's not costumes. It's not dress up. Mm. Then there becomes this box where you can't change your hair or do anything with the intent of being popular or well-received or, you know, selling your wares because this is her job. And I have so little patience for that shit. And I think it's so dumb and no one ever does it to men.
No, of course not.
Leave Maggie alone.
Well, I agree, but I do think that it was the female portion of her fan base that was having that reaction. Now, she speaks to this.
We're weirdos too.
She speaks to this in the New Yorker piece, and she does it in a way that I think is classically Maggie, and that she just says, no, no, no. There was a time I had a pixie cut in like seventh grade. Like, this is me. I do different shit with my hair depending on where I am emotionally in a moment. And so I think
which
that
is like
will,
literally not novel. Now,
of course not.
Just to fend off any charges of hypocrisy, this is not to say that there is not meaning in a haircut. We all know when if Maggie Rogers gets bangs,
yeah,
there's nothing wrong with it, but I'm taking note of it.
Yeah,
I'm taking note of it, and I'm taking note of the fact that it might have some meaning to it.
For sure.
But to I can't connect with the songs because she cut her hair. Like,
no, I know.
Touch grass.
Well, that's it.
Sorry. So,
anyway, we're in this era now, but it speaks to the fragility and delicacy, if you're not careful, about, you know, an incredibly passionate fan base that feels connected to you as a human being, right? It's a different connection, I think, than some people have with other pop stars, other artists, where it's the friend component. Look, we see this with Taylor sometimes, where the fringes of the fan base get controlling and feel like they have a right to be consulted just like a friend on who you date or what you wear or how you cut your hair. And there is something that's very powerful in a connection like that, but it can be, to your point, confining.
Well, and also Taylor gets that in a lot of ways. I do think Taylor is allowed to dress up and change her hair and do stuff like that in a way that maybe it's actually a little bit tougher for someone like Maggie to do, because Taylor, I think people have accepted and come to celebrate that
she gonna change it up every now and then.
Yeah. Changes, disguise, costume, vibe, all of those aesthetics are in the traditional pop star mold of performance is centered and celebrated.
Yeah.
Performance as in performative. Whereas I think for someone like Maggie, who is straddling kind of like singer-songwriterdom and being a version of a pop star, that's trickier.
Mm.
See haircut. Her hair looks great. She's great. Next album, Appetizer.
I mean, I think it's this record. I think she's going to keep making music with Ian, and I'm here for it. I'm excited for it to be a longer process opposed to a flash in the pan moment. I think there was something uncorking about this creative episode over 5 days that now with more time and, you know, more of the, hey, let's write 30 songs and see which ones we want to keep and stick. I mean, they're well on their way at this point. I'm really excited for where she goes from here.
Yeah, I think one thing I wrote down here was, is this the country album or is that coming? And I say that a little bit tongue in cheek just because there are so many of these kind of country crossover things right now. And we talked about Ian being involved and the connection with Casey and also that, you know, she's doing stuff with Zach Bryan.
Give me my dog's back. Everything that dies makes its way back.
And
she's on stage with Springsteen and Zach Bryan in New York City. Yeah, I mean.
Right. So I do, a question that I have is kind of like, but I think on this album, she wears those vibes in a nice way where it's subtle, but also she could go all in. Right. And that's not what she's doing here. And so my question was, is that coming or is this the version of that she wants to do?
It's a good question. I mean, this feels a little bit more Phoebe Bridgers than Zach Bryan to me. And of course, she's collaborated with Phoebe before. But I think what sits with me about Heard It in a Past Life is the rhythmic components of her creations that I think Pharrell instantly pointed out when he heard Alaska for the first time was rooted a little bit in her banjo playing. Like he could hear some of the banjo in the rhythm and the percussion and all that. This record doesn't have that.
Can I just before you make whatever point you're about to make, because I don't want to throw you off when you're actually in the middle of making it. I just need to say, so I love the Pharrell video. Can we acknowledge that when Pharrell throws out Wu-Tang, it's really weird?
It's fucking awesome. What are you talking about? He's Wu-Tang's like, for the kids.
It's like a drug to me. I've never heard anything like this. It's like the first time people heard Wu-Tang.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. Like,
but I appreciated that as a comment. I mean, to tap into our Beyonce conversation in that, like, it's not genre constrained. It's like you hear something that's fresh and different and authentic, and it can be Wu-Tang over here, or it can be this girl who seems to have fallen out of the woods of Maryland and into a Berlin club and combined that noise with a banjo and made this, and it's all the same experience.
Yes, and his point obviously was not, this sounds like Wu-Tang. It was, I haven't heard anything like this before, and that is akin to the first time. I just, Pharrell is being Pharrell a little bit in the video. Pharrell knows that he's in a video. And
yes.
While it is like a really, really beautiful, wonderful, like if you can't have fun watching that video, like defrost your heart and soul, because it's just really lovely.
Fair enough.
And everybody's awkwardness. Pharrell is just doing a little bit of a Pharrell thing. Anyway, continue. What were you saying?
No, next album, I wonder if she incorporates some of the more rhythmic parts of her first record into LP4, as she would call it before she gave it a name.
Right. Yeah. And whether that's in the sort of back to more of the synth pop adjacent vein or not, I think would be interesting too. I mean, I think she's talked about her songwriting approach, you know, when she got to NYU and first few years of school there being very much based in melody, and she wrote melodies first, but part of that experience going to Berlin and getting a little bit more immersed in that club culture was connecting with music rhythmically and rhythmically first in a way that was new to her. So she could do that in a way that doesn't necessarily use those exact sounds. Again, doesn't pull from that quite as much, but just uses the rhythm as a basis or not. That'd be cool. I like it. This is one where there are a lot of things that I would be curious to hear what's next. I have some questions. There's some things that seem very possible, but because this album was the product of, you know, 5 days and as you said, that real flash in the pan moment, I don't know that it feels like it's leading her somewhere specific or boxing her in anywhere, which is great. Do you have a best lyric?
Yeah, I do. And we talked about it a little bit. To me, it's From the Kill. I love the line, "You kept your secrets, stole my weaknesses in your white t-shirt that I couldn't fill."
You kept my secrets and stole my weaknesses in your white t-shirt that I couldn't fill.
Something about the white t-shirt that I couldn't fill. Like, you can just see in those relationships where, in particular early days, and you're borrowing each other's clothes.
Yeah.
And she's in an oversized t-shirt to get to the like 80s, 90s rom-com. Something about that line brought me straight to Say Anything. You know, I gave her my heart. She gave me a pen.
Yeah.
She gave me a pen. Gave my heart and she gave me a pen.
It's a sort of mismatch of, and that's what this song is sort of about. So I love that imagery, and it just, that part slayed me.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't even think of it in that way, but the line, the white t-shirt line did stick with me and was vivid. So that's cool. Mine was just the opening of Don't Forget Me. My friend Sally's getting married, and to me that sounds so scary. I had a lot of contenders, but to me that was the show don't tell version of My Saturn Has Returned.
My friend Sally's getting sounds so scary.
Huh.
And we've spent so much, like, clearly this is a concept that people are interested in, and the fact that she did it, and she, you know, to me she hit the nail on the head. She, you know, that you just get it, and she doesn't have to say it. Not that there's anything wrong with saying it, but it was cool to me to hear someone approach that in a way that wasn't quite so on the nose, but actually ended up being a little bit more, I think, potent because of it. So I think it's a lyrically very strong album. I think her writing is consistently a real strength for her. But that, to me, I chose because it just seems to be this thing that everybody kind of wants to write about. And I think she's done it in a very good way.
As a Maggie advocate, I cannot tell you how happy I am about the songs that have really connected deeply with you. Because I
they're
really
not
think,
yours. They're
no, they are. But I think just like industry guys will, and what the fuck do industry guys know? But industry guys will say, oh, Don't Forget Me for sure. But The Kill and If Now Is Then are the ones that could be like the stratospheric hits. It's just a reminder that Maggie is also like Casey in a really good way. Maggie is a vibe. And if you connect with that vibe, there's so much of what she creates that is really digestible. And again, in particular to women of a certain ilk.
So he calls me up 15 minutes before the reservation. Yeah, no, I'm here for it. I'm super here for it.
Like,
shall we grade the album?
Yeah, go for it.
Ever.
I mean, I'm biased. I'm, you know, so who cares what I think? You know what I think, but I'm curious, really, where does this one land for you?
I gave it, and I sort of copped out too in some ways, but I gave it a 91. Okay. It felt like this is part of what is so interesting to me in going through all of these albums and talking about all of these artists, which is just getting a little bit of a snapshot on the moment in the music industry and the moment in the sort of pop girl landscape, which is fascinating because there are these people like Maggie and Casey is another one where they have really strong, like potent fan bases. They are household names to the people who are listening to this podcast, to me, to my friends. It feels a little bit wrong in some ways to have just given the Beyoncé album an A and say, I really love this Maggie Rogers album. It is also an A.
Yeah, I get it.
Because in some ways, the scope and the ambition is a little bit different.
It's different, yeah.
Although I do think that, like, I think this is well done. I think it sounds like her, but it also sounds like something I've never heard from her before. And that's really cool. I think they showed some editing. She sounds awesome. It's funny. It's creative. So where that all worked out for me was at a 91.
Yeah, I think it's exactly, it's like my son's Spanish and science grades. Like, it's a low A, but it's trending up. And I know that he's going to get it all the way up next report card. Because, like, there are some, to me, again, I think there's some transcendent writing on this record. And she did it in 5 days. 5 days. So let's, with the creative juices flowing, with her, you know, creating some structure for creativity to exist and still be like a human being that is not only represented by that creativity, like with all that in place and the work that she's done and the academia that she's sort of pursued, now with more time and interest and passion for the creativity as an artist, I can't wait to see what she builds on from here. But I love this record. I am wearing the F out a couple of the songs on this album and I can't wait to see what she does with this live.
And can't wait to hear what other people think about it. Really had a lot of fun with this one. All right, this has been Every Single Album. I'm Nora Princiotti. As always, he is Nathan Hubbard. Thank you to Kaya McMullen for producing this episode. We will be back next week to talk about Taylor Swift.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.